The second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be speaking with Dr. Susan Nagel. She is a physician. She's also a lay Catholic missionary. And we'll be talking with her about some of her experiences providing medical care in Africa to some places that are very remote where people certainly need the help. She is an Urbana girl. She grew up in Urbana. She attended to the University of Illinois and then went to medical school at Southern Illinois University. And when she finished her training, she decided that she really did indeed want to go to a place in the world where people needed help very much. And so she settled on Africa. And over the past 20 years, she has lived and practiced in several places in Africa, in Tanzania, in Sudan, and in Kenya. And much of her energy and her medical work has been devoted to providing care for women and children. She is here visiting in Champaign-Urbana. Her parents still live here. So she's back on a rare visit, and we thought it'd be interesting to have her here in the studio to talk a little bit about her experiences. And I'm pleased that she could be with us. Of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. It's a privilege and an honor to talk with you today.
You did, when you were a little girl, you didn't start out thinking that you would be a doctor. At what point in your life did you start thinking that you would like to go to med school and train and be a physician?
I was always interested in health care. I was a candy striper at Mercy Hospital. And so, as is typical, I started thinking about nursing. But when I was in high school, I more seriously considered becoming a physician. And as I went through my training, it became more clear that I really wanted to try and figure out what was the problem with the patient, and that being a physician was what I was really interested in.
Mm-hmm. So you went to school here. You got an undergraduate here in biology. Then you went on to Southern and got your med degree there.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And then after that, I did a family practice residency program in Carbondale. That was 3 years. Mm-hmm. And when I finished the residency program, that's when I decided that it was a good time to do some missionary work that would take a few years, because I didn't have a private practice and overhead and a lot of responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Well, what made you decide that that was what you wanted to do, rather than going out and starting into a more conventional kind of medical practice?
When I was in college, I had done a lot of volunteer work. I had worked in Appalachia with the Newman Center on vacations. I had gone to Nicaragua for a month doing a vaccination program. And when I was a medical student, I did 2 weeks in the Dominican Republic with the Christian Medical and Dental Society. And each of those volunteer experiences was very good. I really liked them. I liked working in cross-cultural situations. I felt like I had skills that could help in those areas. But for a very short time, you can't learn a language or really understand the culture. So I wanted to do something for a longer period of time. And I also knew that if it was going to be for a longer period of time, I would need some support spiritually as well as physically and financially. And so I wanted to go with the Catholic Church because that was my faith background. And I also wanted to have the opportunity to marry. I didn't want to be a sister. And so at that point in the mid-80s, probably the organization that had the most experience with lay people in overseas mission in the Catholic Church was Mary Knoll. And that's the Catholic Overseas Foreign Mission Society and Congregation. And so I contacted them, and they interviewed me and accepted me and chose to go to Africa. Hmm.
So was it your choice to go to Africa, or did they say to you, we think we would like to send you to Africa?
They gave me the opportunity to say where I was interested. I think thinking that given I had been in Latin America that I would be interested to go back to Latin America. At that time in the 80s, the countries that would have been open to having a physician work were in the middle of a lot of conflict and turmoil. Nicaragua was at war. Bolivia had a lot of problems. And I personally, at that point, did not want to work in a war situation. I also, for no good reason, could say why I felt called to go to Africa, but that's where I felt like I should go. And so I told them that, hoping that they wouldn't think I was crazy. And they didn't, and they actually, it's a very needy continent, and they had places where they needed physicians there, Tanzania in particular, which was a very peaceful country. And so the fit for both my needs and their needs was good, and they could match it.
Yeah. You went there as a physician to provide medical care. What exactly does it mean to be a lay missionary? And is there, do you see some kind of religious component to what it is that you do?
As a physician, I could go with any non-governmental organization, such as Médecins Sans Frontières or one of the UN organizations, and they're all very good organizations. But for my own personal needs, I wanted to practice medicine in a more holistic, faith-filled way. I didn't want it just to be the job I was doing, but the life that I was living, particularly given that I'm from a Catholic tradition. I wanted to be able to live in a community where people tried to improve the community. We all worship in the same church. We try to improve our lives, the lives of women and children and those that are less fortunate. And so in Maryknoll, lay people have the opportunity to participate through the church in not just the health care, but in other areas of life, such as human rights or improvement of the community, with the support of the church and the local people as well. I have always worked as a physician under the health care provided by a Catholic diocese in another country. So there's a local church there. There are people who say, these are our needs, and this is what we would like you to help us with.
Hmm. Does that limit what you can do with your practice?
The church organizations that are available have usually been very simple, and I've had to build them up. So I'd say, basically, I've always worked in places where there's been a tremendous need, and I was starting at the beginning in places where there were no other physicians, trying to work with the nurses and the clinical officers, which would be similar to physician assistants, and trying to get them to work to their full potential, to teach them as much as possible, and then move on someplace else.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm just thinking, I hate to go right to such a controversial subject right so early in the conversation, but, for example, you spent a lot of your time working with women, providing obstetric care, working with women and children, and I think there are probably a lot of people that argue one of the things that developing societies need is some help with family planning. And that being, if you're going to work in a Catholic context, then there are some things that you can do or will do, and there are some things that you won't do. How, for example, if that's what you're doing and you're trying to provide some basic sort of information and basic health care to people, and you look at something as basic as that, how do you approach that?
In the beginning in Tanzania, the area was very rural, and I can really only remember one time when I wanted to use contraceptives in a woman who had a heart condition and her husband had more than one wife. And so I talked with the husband, explaining that I wanted to help her stabilize her heart condition and that in order to do that, she couldn't become pregnant. And he was very much against that, and basically I never saw her again. And the church wouldn't have any problems with using contraception for medical conditions. Generally, in Tanzania, I did not have women coming to me asking for contraceptives. They had much more day-to-day survival issues. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, I think women in Africa want to have a good number of children, but they need time in between their children in order to stay healthy enough and be able to provide for their children. And most of the time when they want to do some kind of family planning, the difficulty comes with their partner. And you have to have some kind of relationship between the two of them in order to make sure that you don't cause difficulties. Mm. In general, though, I would say the most important thing in terms of family planning is the education of girls and women. And if you can put your emphasis in that area, those girls and women will choose partners who will work with them, and then they will be able to find ways to manage their families the way it's best for them.
Well, that points at something, and that is what I'm sure is a line that you always have to walk between your looking at the people that you're trying to help and work with, and you're thinking about what you think that they need and what they think that they need, and where the primary direction comes from, whether you indeed take your lead from what people are telling you that they need, the kind of help that they're looking for. And maybe there are cases where immediate needs are very obvious. Nobody needs to tell anybody else. It's you can just look at the person and realize what they need. You know, but I mean, steering this course between what people are looking for, what they come to you for, and then you're thinking, well, it would really be good if I could do these things. I mean, how do you move between those two points?
The most urgent problem that comes to my mind in Kenya at the moment where I'm working is the whole problem with AIDS. Mm-hmm. And the biggest problem with treating patients with AIDS in that country at the moment is the shame and stigma that's associated with it. So in order to try to address the issue, first of all, you have to find out who's infected and who's not. And there are government programs as well as church-sponsored programs to screen people. And so we try to encourage that. We also try to work at educational levels to teach people that this is a disease. This is something that can be treated now and that people can live for years with it. And that if we don't find out who's sick and start them on treatment, parents are going to die and there are going to be a lot of orphans left with nobody to take care of them. So it's a very multifactorial problem that you can't just address from the point of view of diagnosis and treatment. Mm-hmm. We start with that certainly at our health center and in the clinics that the diocese works with. But we are also trying to work with schools, with pastors, village elders, priests, religious organizations, so that they themselves can be well educated and try to change their opinion about the disease and how they're going to address it in the future.
Mm-hmm. What about prevention?
For AIDS?
Yeah.
There are several government programs. One is the prevention of mother-to-child transmission. Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do is to screen all pregnant women to find out who's positive. Those that are positive are then given medication that can decrease the transmission from mother to child from 30% to 50% down to 10, as little as 10%. Those that are not positive are educated as to how the disease is transmitted so that hopefully they can prevent that in the future. Mm-hmm. They also have a voluntary counseling and testing centers program. So there are centers that are trying to be set up all around the country where people can go to be tested to find out whether they're positive. And then in those situations, if they're negative, they're counseled as to how it's, again, how it's transmitted and how to prevent it. And if they're positive, then they're referred for treatment immediately.
Yeah. Well, that gets me back to I'm sorry again to go back to this, but it gets me back to condoms, just because I think that there are some people who feel that, you know, that's one of the easiest and one of the least costly things that you could do to prevent the spread. And the Catholic Church is not exactly high on condoms. How do you look at that? This basic mechanical, not very expensive thing that you could do, where the church says, no, we don't want you to do that.
You also have to look at the cultural context that people are living in. There's this recent study looking at the first sexual contact for girls in Kenya. 30% of those girls were raped on their first sexual contact. So there's not an issue with using condoms in those situations. Also, one of the biggest problems in the continent is war. And men who have guns demand what they want, and there isn't an opportunity to say no or to decide whether or not you're going to use a condom. So in many of these situations, that's not an issue at all. However, that doesn't mean that people who have choices shouldn't be educated about the way the disease is spread and the way they can choose to protect themselves. And I think that certainly in situations where women don't have control, where they're and in most cases in Africa, women don't. Women are regarded as property, mm-hmm. and when they are married, they are required to provide certain services for their husband, and if he's not faithful to them, then how is she going to protect herself? And I see that it's very important to try to educate women to find ways that they can protect themselves. But if he's going to force her, she's very limited in the choices that she has.
Yeah. Our guest this morning, you know, I'm told I think I have been mispronouncing your name. You pronounce your name Nagley?
Yes.
All right. Well, my apologies. Believe me, as someone who's gone through my life being mispronounced, it's something that I try to get right. Dr. Susan Nagley, she is a physician and has now for 20 years been living and practicing in Africa, in Tanzania, in Sudan, and now in Kenya. She grew up here in Champaign-Urbana, is back home visiting parents, and so she was good enough to stop by and spend a little time talking with us about her work. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. And we do have someone here who would like to join in the conversation, so we will get to them right on our line number one. The caller's in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
This is Barb Peckham, and I just want to tell you that Susan Nagley, I admire so very much. Do you realize how much money she could be making here in America if she were a doctor? And she's a part of my church. She's a member of our church. She comes to speak every once in a while. And I am also a neighbor of Susan's. But she is such a wonderful, giving person. And, you know, I want her to know that. And I admire you so very much, Susan. You are a remarkable lady.
Thanks, Barb. I'm very grateful for all your kind words. I certainly didn't come out of a vacuum. I grew up here in Urbana, Illinois. I'm a product of Central Illinois and the good community that's here. And so it's all of you who've made me who I am and have helped me to be able to do what I'm able to do in a place that doesn't have what we have here. And so we're all in this together, and I'm really grateful for everyone's support.
And also, Susan, I just want to express my own personal opinion, but I really feel like the Catholic Church should allow people to use contraception. I feel like I'm a fairly devout Catholic, but that is the one area that I totally disagree with, and I'm hoping down the line that we're going to have a Pope who feels the way that so many of American Catholics feel. So that's my personal opinion, but again, thank you so much for all that you do.
Thanks, Mark.
All right, well, thanks for the call. Other folks, yep. If you're interested in calling in, you can do that, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. I guess I'd have to say that I admire you, too, and that I would admire anybody who has, you know, such strongly held belief and has decided that I have this ability and I'm going to go out and I'm going to try to do something constructive with it. And I guess you have to admire somebody who's like that. Now, you're giving me sort of a funny smile, and I'm sure that you hear that a lot from people, and that probably you think to yourself, well, that's just what I do. I mean, you're not going to propose yourself for sainthood. And I'm sure that you would like to kind of say, well, yeah, okay, that's very nice. But how do you deal with all that admiration?
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to just remember that we're all human beings on this earth. And so I just keep in mind that I'm just one of many, many, many people. I don't think that what I'm doing is terribly extraordinary. There are many other people who are doing the same thing. I'm not the only one. You just happen to know me, and I happen to have the microphone at the moment. Mm-hmm. I think that all of us have to do what we're called to do, and that's the most important thing. And in terms of financial remuneration and what I could be making in this country, that's certainly not an issue for me. For me, the issue is that we all have what we need, and I have never suffered. I've always had enough food in front of me, even when I was in some of the starkest situations in southern Sudan. So I truly do believe that wherever I go, if it's where I'm meant to be, enough will be provided both now and when I'm old, alone, and retired. But I think that, you know, if each one of us will try to do what we can do, the world will become a better place. And I just have skills that can help people in Africa in a cross-cultural situation. I have the ability to learn languages, to understand in their culture what's causing them problems, and to try and work with it. And I'm grateful that I've been able to choose the difficulties that I live with. If I had to work here in some more litigious difficulties, I would be much less happy.
Yeah, you've been there now for 20 years. How much longer do you think you would want to live and work in Africa?
For the moment, this is certainly where my expertise is. I know tropical medicine very well, particularly that related to East Africa. I know the language and the cultures of that area of the world, and there's a tremendous need there. There's a big drain on healthcare workers in East Africa. When nurses and physicians become educated, particularly if they have families, they often want to move to areas where they can make more money and where their children can get better education. So for the moment, I would see myself continuing in that part of the world because I think mutually I have a lot to offer and they have a big need.
Yeah. Well, we have some other people we can talk with. We have somebody on cell phone. They're next in line, line number one. Hello.
Hi. My question is regarding the recent awardment of the African woman, the Nobel Peace Prize, and her push for the environment and sustainable development. And I'm wondering if you're seeing any sort of impact with sustainable, you know, is it spreading? Is it impacting the areas where you are? And how that could help improve the healthcare system in Africa.
So you're referring to Wangari Maathai, the Kenyan woman who was selected to receive the Nobel Peace Prize?
Yeah, correct.
Yes, Wangari Maathai is a wonderful woman, and her whole aim is to try to improve Kenyan society and therefore women and children. And
are you seeing an impact in your areas firsthand with improvement in sustainable development and so forth?
It's very slow. One of the big problems in Kenya is that there is a lot of corruption. They did peacefully elect a new government in 2002 who said that they would make it their priority to decrease corruption. Unfortunately, they haven't succeeded, and many Kenyans, I think, will tell you that they don't think that the current government is trying hard enough. So I would say that, no, at the moment we're not seeing a very good improvement in that area, and I think a big problem is the corruption.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to Savoy. That's the next caller here, line number two. Hello.
Hello. I'm so glad to be able to speak with you. Was your father Tom?
Yes, my father is Tom Nagle. He was a dentist in Urbana.
Yes, yes. I'm very sorry I didn't get to meet you as a little girl. I used to, let me go on to Africa. It is such a very large place. It's easy for ordinary white guys like me to forget how large it really is. May I ask you just a few questions? How many languages of theirs can you now speak?
The first language I learned was Swahili, which is the national language in Tanzania. When I moved to southern Sudan, I learned Juba Arabic, which is a local trade language, and it was actually very easy for me to learn it because half of Swahili is based on Arabic, and their form of Arabic is very, very simple. So I was able to speak that quite well. Then I moved to an area where most people only spoke the local language, which was Tiposa. So I tried to learn that, and I was fair at it. I could certainly make my way through the clinic, but I couldn't hold conversations regarding day-to-day matters. And then moving back to Kenya, I now use Swahili again. So there are three African languages that I'm able to speak, two far better than the third.
Well, most excellent. Were you anywhere near this place in the news, Darfur?
Darfur is in the west of Sudan. I was working in Eastern Equatoria province, specifically in the Diocese of Tourette, which is in the southeastern corner of Sudan. I worked there for 12 years, and everything that occurred with the war while I was there seems to have moved to Darfur. So it's very troubling what's going on in that country, because there was a peace agreement signed on January 9th of this year. And whereas that area of the country, Eastern Equatoria, no longer has bombing and shelling and fighting, it seems like the problem has just been moved to another part of the country, which is Darfur.
Were you there long enough to develop some understanding of what's going on over there?
I think in 12 years, yes, I could get a pretty good idea of what was going on.
Please share. What's going on there?
I think one of the basic problems is that there are tremendous natural resources located in the south of Sudan. The biggest is probably oil, but there's also minerals, hardwood, forests, and very good farming land, as well as people. And over the decades and centuries, those resources have been exploited by the north. And the southerners have not been allowed to govern themselves. And the southerners want to govern themselves and have control over their lives. And so when they don't have that opportunity, they have gone to war, first in 1955 and most recently in 1983. There are problems with religion in the country, and people would like to simplify the problems and say it's a fight against Arabs and Christians, but I think that's much too simple. I think there are also a lot of other factors, and it's a very complicated situation, and the more you learn about it, the more complicated it will become. Something that's gone on for this long will take a very long time to resolve. So it's a very, very complicated situation in Sudan.
Were you able to learn anything about who these Janjaweed are?
I never worked in Darfur, and we did not have Janjaweed in Eastern Equatoria.
A tribe or what?
The Janjaweed, from what I understand, are militia who are supported by the government to terrorize the local populations.
With the goal being?
They would have to tell you that.
Okay. Well, last point I want to make is I think you should get a little closer to the idea of thinking yourself as being unusual. It's obviously a great and good thing, what you're doing, and that's all.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call. We'll go on. We'll go to Urbana, and this is line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is Paul Doble.
Hello, Paul. How are you?
Good.
So nice to hear from you.
Sorry, I had a in my throat. Susan, we're in a country of great wealth, a high standard of living. You are familiar with the world of the have-nots. In your opinion, are we sharing enough of our resources to support you and and others like you? Excuse me. That calls for an opinion, but I think it would be an educated opinion based on what you've done and what you've seen. You may not have been in this country long enough to realize the standard of living that we've become accustomed to. Are we doing enough to support the have-nots and people like you that are trying to make something out of not a whole lot?
I would have to say no. I don't think that this country does enough financially. And it always amazes me when I come back to see how much money people spend on some things. We all only have so much money to spend, and it just you have to decide where you want to spend your money. Certainly, I see people spending money that I think could be better spent elsewhere. But I think more important than money, probably one of the big things that we in America should look at is educating ourselves about the way the rest of the world lives and why do so many people in the rest of the world hate us. And that is the way many people overseas look at Americans. We're seen as arrogant. We think we know it all. We think we have the answers to how people need to solve their problems. And whereas we certainly have a very high standard of living, and we have solved many of our problems in good and appropriate ways, we don't have the answers to how everybody can solve their problems. Only those people in those situations that have the problems can really figure out the best way to solve their problem. And I think we as a country need to look at ourselves as part of the world, and then try to function that way.
And in terms of your own support for the endeavors that you're engaged in, do you have adequate support? Do we need to do more?
I am a missionary with Mary Knoll. I'm part of the association. Mary Knoll has three branches, and lay people are part of the association. Then, of course, there are the priests and the brothers who are part of the society and the sisters who are part of the congregation. And, you know, the Catholic Church has always supported priests, brothers, and sisters very well. But I think that the support for lay people has been minimal because we haven't had much history with it. Protestants certainly do a much better job of, first of all, seeing the importance of lay people, families, and children in evangelization, and then secondly, supporting them. And so I would certainly hope that in the future our church would look at not only the need for lay people in evangelization, but then also to support us financially so that we can do this kind of work in the future.
Mm-hmm. Do you do much yourself in the way of fundraising while you're here in this country? Or?
Yeah, this year I had come back for my 1 month's vacation, and the association asked me would I take 2 more weeks to do fundraising, because we need to become financially self-sufficient within the next couple of years. And up to this point, we have been supported a lot by the society, which is the priests and the brothers, but that will end very shortly. And so I have been doing more talks and trying to communicate more with people about what we're doing so that hopefully people will also support lay people in overseas mission in the Catholic Church.
Well, maybe, Susan, we can all give up our second or third TV sets and support you a little more.
Thanks for your support, Paul. You're a wonderful person.
Well, that's all I have except to say thanks for what you're doing.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We'll go again to another caller here. We have somebody on a cell phone. They're next here, line number one. Hello.
Hi, Dr. Susan.
Hello.
I just have to tell you what a great inspiration you are to me, and I'm sure to almost everyone. I'd like to know, I'm not Catholic, but I would like to know what could be done to support you, where I would send any monies to support what you're doing. I'd also be two quick questions. What do you do to relax over there when you do have some social time off? What do you do? And I'd also like to know what the population think about our involvement, if they know about it, in Iraq. I'll hang up and listen. And thank you again for what you do.
Thank you. Your first question about where could support be sent, the Mary Knoll Association has the abbreviation MMAF. And the promotion address is Box 307, Mary Knoll, New York, 10545-0307. And so any checks or funds that you could send to that address could either be addressed to the association itself, or if you want to address it specifically to my mission account, then I can give you an accounting of what I do with it. Your second question was about...
Well, he was interested in what you do in your off hours.
My leisure time.
Yes.
Well, first of all, I have to admit to the fact that I'm a workaholic. So, and actually, I love my work. I'm a very privileged woman in that I can do what I enjoy. However, I have been trying to get that more in balance in the latter part of my life. I love music. I play the piano. I don't have a piano there, but I do have a guitar. I love swimming, so I have most recently in the last 15 months had access to a pool, and I try and go once a week to swim. And then I enjoy light reading, but I'd say probably the thing I enjoy most is eating and chatting. we friends just get together, and I think it's probably an art that's being lost in the age of video and email. And I really enjoy just sitting around having a very good meal and talking with people about anything in life, you know. And then the third.
And do well. The caller asked specifically what people thought about the U.S. involvement in Iraq, and maybe more generally, I suppose. I don't know. Do people sit around and talk about international affairs, U.S. policy, U.S. involvement in the world? Do people, because you're in America, sort of grab you by the collar and say, well, "What's this country of yours doing?" Or what do you think about that?
People don't grab me by the collar, but it's very clear that they do think and discuss about those issues, and they have their opinions. In general, most Kenyans that I heard talking about our involvement in Iraq were very much against it. They feel that it's an illegal war and that they do not support what we're doing there. However, many of the southern Sudanese that I have talked with certainly support it because they feel that it shows that we are a very strong country, that if we can control the situation in Iraq, then maybe we can also control the situation in southern Sudan and stop the atrocities that are occurring there. I personally would not agree with that viewpoint. I lived for 12 years in a place that was basically controlled by terrorism, and they tried to solve the problems with war the entire time. They have signed a peace agreement, but they don't have peace. And I think it's going to take a lot more than war to try to solve all of the hurt and the suffering and the anger and the problems that are behind a lot of these situations. And I think it's going to be a long time before we're able to solve the problems in Iraq. Terrorists are very hard to control when they're willing to give up their lives and commit suicide.
It's back earlier in the interview when we were talking about how it is that you ended up going to Africa. You said something like you had some experience in Latin America, and one might think because of that it would have been the natural place to go, except that at that time it was very dangerous. There was a lot of war going on there, so you thought, well, maybe better go someplace where there's not war. So you were in Tanzania for 6 years, but then you ended up going to Sudan.
So how did that happen?
Well,
I had been in Tanzania for 5 years. I was very comfortable at that point in my ministry, and it would have been very easy to stay on. However, one of our other lay missioners who was working in Kenya and was supposed to work with me in Tanzania but wasn't able to get a visa to do it, was looking for another ministry, and some of the suggestions were to look at Sudan and Ethiopia. So I went to Sudan to look at the Diocese of Turit to see what was there. And in fact, that diocese had asked for missionaries to come help with the healthcare program. They thought they would get a sister. They didn't realize that there were lay people available. And when they met me and when I saw the situation, we realized that we both could help each other. So once I was able to go to the country, see exactly what the situation was and what support systems I had there, I was able to say, yes, I can function in this situation. There's enough support here, and I think I can not only function, but I can thrive, which in fact I did.
One of the realities that I'm sure that you have to deal with, and anybody who works in a non-governmental organization have to manage to get on with the government in the place where they are. And it may be, you know, complicated that the organization has its agenda, the things that it wants to do. The government has its agenda. And in some cases, those agendas may parallel one another, but not necessarily. And I could expect that a lot of places where the governments would think what they're interested in from an NGO is what they can get out of them and to make sure that that NGO causes them the least amount of trouble that they possibly can. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of your experiences in that regard. And are there difficulties in whatever relationship that you have with the government? Or is the government at that point maybe so remote so that it's really not for you doing what you do is maybe not that much of an issue?
I certainly have worked in two very different situations. So I'd like to put Tanzania and Kenya in one set. Okay, there are well-functioning governments. They have their agendas. And I have always worked in the local church. So my relationship with the governments in those countries would be different than an NGO, because I'm working with local people at their request and trying to partner with them, and then they themselves function with their local governments. So the Catholic Church in both Tanzania and Kenya have representation, and they have certain bodies that interact with the local government. Southern Sudan was a totally different situation. I worked in rebel-held areas. There was no local government. There was a rebel army that was the civil authority. And they basically looked at us white people working there as members of NGOs with a lot of money. And it was very confusing to them to work with missionaries, because we always worked under the auspice of the Catholic Church and the local bishop. And in eastern Equatoria, Bishop Paride Taban was a wonderful advocate for all of the pastoral agents working in his diocese. So I was often approached by local authorities and put in difficult situations, but I always had the wisdom and the support of the local church to help me figure out what was the best thing to do in that situation, and oftentimes to protect me in dangerous situations. And I was very grateful that I was able to work with him in his diocese.
We are moving into about our last 7, 8, 9 minutes, and maybe I should introduce again our guest, Dr. Susan Negley. She is a physician and is also a Catholic lay missionary, and for something like 20 years now, she's been working in Africa and living and working in the places that we mentioned, in Tanzania, in Sudan, in southern Sudan, and now she lives in Kenya. She grew up in Urbana. Her parents still live here. She's here on a visit. She went to the University of Illinois, got her medical degree at Southern Illinois University, and then shortly after that became involved in the work that she's doing now, and has done for the last couple of decades. And I thought it would be interesting to have her here talk a little bit about her experiences. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. I would imagine that a lot of what you do is basic kind of health education, and that that might be complicated that by the fact that the people that you come to try to work with already have some ideas about why it is you get sick and what it is you do to get well, which may or may not square up with
what really happens.
And that some of what you have to do is to try to get across to people a little bit of a basic theory of disease and why it is that people get sick, and what you can do to try to stay healthy. And then when you're sick, when you're really sick, what you can do to try and get well.
Again, there's a big difference between practicing in Tanzania and Kenya and in southern Sudan. Both Tanzania and Kenya have much better educated populations, and so we're not starting at ground zero. When I went to the most recent area that I worked in, Toposa Land in southern Sudan, it was for me quite an eye-opener to see what it's like to work with a population who has no concept of modern medicine. So I'm glad that I was able to adjust to the cultural differences in Tanzania and Kenya first, because, yes, most people have ideas different from modern medicine. There are many beliefs regarding curses, witchcraft, problems in relationships between people that cause illness. And I think actually a lot of that is very true. We have a lot more problems related to stress and difficulties in relationships that cause organic illnesses. However, in southern Sudan, there was no concept of viruses, bacteria. There was not even a word for cancer, although I saw many very far advanced cancers there. So in that situation, I was working in a situation where they had no context to put what I was doing into their belief system. And it took a lot of time to just establish a relationship with the people and for them to realize that some of the things that we did benefit them. And when they saw that, then they would start coming back. With a disease like AIDS, where we were trying to teach them about a virus that can live in their bodies for 5 to 10 years before it ever surfaces, and then it can kill them, they basically could not understand that and would not believe it. They feel like this is a white woman who is just trying to scare them. And until they start seeing the disease themselves and can understand from physical sight what's happening, a lot of our education will not be very useful.
Hmm. Well, let's talk with someone else here, another Urbana listener on our line one. Hello.
Hello. I've had to tune in and out, so I might have missed this if you've addressed it already. I guess many times when we hear the word missionary, we think about people going to try to convert populations from their local belief system to either Christianity or Islam or some other major religion. And I was wondering if you could discuss whatever role that might have in your work, if any. I have no idea, and I will listen offline.
All right.
I am a Catholic missionary, and I felt very uncomfortable in the beginning using that term because I don't proselytize or talk directly about my faith. And I think most of us Catholics, we don't feel very comfortable talking about our faith. Protestants are much, much more comfortable with that. So I'm trying to live my life and in a way that comes from what I believe. People aren't stupid. They can see that if you're doing something that is benefiting people, but you don't seem to be doing it for money or other amenities, they do start asking, why are you doing it? But the other thing is that it's important for me to work within the local church. And I don't have all the answers. I have some answers, and they have some answers. And so what we do is we work together. We're on the same committees trying to build this church or trying to address this problem of AIDS in our community. And so what we do is we put our heads together, and in difficult situations, we support one another. And it's not just me imparting to them. I'm a part of the community, and I am as much being evangelized by their faith and their ability to not only survive but thrive in very difficult situations. So that's the way I live my missionary life.
Hmm. And you, I guess people need to understand, as you say, that you are part of this organization, a Catholic organization, and a part of the organization in the places where you live are priests and nuns, who maybe slightly more primary job is to do that, and that you, at least as I understand, you think that primarily the job that you're there to do is to be a doctor and to do that.
Yes, that certainly is my job, but we do have lay people that also would do catechesis, pastoral work in the communities. And, you know, as a member of any organization, we're all trying to move forward and to figure out in this organization what is the best way to live our lives. So none of us agree 100% with everything the organization does, and none of us have all of the answers. I don't think that we should be so arrogant as to believe that. We need to continually realize that each of us individuals has to search and to grow and to become better.
How, for the people that you've worked with, how do they react to your being a woman and in the role that you're in?
Always I feel like being white in African societies has given me a status above other women. They automatically assume that I know more and give me more respect, with the exception of some places in southern Sudan. Men there did not respect me as a white woman the way other Africans would have. I say that it probably gives me an in to working with women and children, which is really what my love is. I am able to work with victims of sexual assault, which are by far and away more often women than men. And being a woman, I am able, I think, to provide the service better than a man would be able to.
Hmm. Do you have men coming to you with their medical complaints, or do men not feel comfortable going to a woman doctor and talking about what's up with them?
I have had plenty of men coming. It would be hard to know how many men don't come because I'm a woman. I would say that in general, most of the places that I have worked in, there's been such need that if a person is really sick and nobody has been able to help them, even if it's a difficult medical problem that involves a sexual area, they find a way to somehow or another present it to me so that we can help them.
Well, we've come to the end of the time, and we're going to have to stop just because we have used our time. And I want to say to our guest, Dr. Susan Nagling, to thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
She is a physician and a Catholic lay worker, lay missioner, and is associated with Mary Knoll. And again, if people are interested in finding out about Mary Knoll and they have internet access, there's a website. Doesn't now everybody have one? And I think if people go to Mary Knoll, MaryKnoll, MaryKnoll.org, they can find out all about it.
Anything they need to know. The internet is wonderful, isn't it?
All right. Well, again, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Our program here, Focus 580, is made possible today in part by grants from 10,000 villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts at 428 North Main in Bloomington, providing income to third world artisans by marketing their handicrafts and telling their stories in North America. That's about it for us here on Focus. Just real quick, I'll mention that tomorrow morning in the first part of the program, we'll be looking at the global small arms trade, and our guest will be Matthew Schroeder. He is manager of the Arms Sales Monitoring Project. And in hour number two, we'll be talking with Sister Helen Prejean, founder of the Moratorium Campaign. She is a Roman Catholic sister who has become one of perhaps the leading spokesperson against capital punishment in the United States, certainly among the leading people speaking against it. She has a book out fairly recently titled The Death of Innocence, an Eyewitness Account, in which she makes the arguments that she believes, and indeed people who are not guilty have been executed in this country. So she'll be talking with us by telephone tomorrow in the second hour of the show. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions, comments. Now, of course, we hope you'll stay tuned because up next is the Afternoon Magazine and the host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we're going to talk about the New Madrid earthquakes of the early 19th century. Our guest will be Jay Feldman. He is the author of When the Mississippi Ran Backwards. The book tells the story of the quakes, the chaos they caused, and their impact on American history. He'll join us at 1:06. Let's take a look now at prices on the Chicago Board of Trade. May wheat is trading at $3, down 6. July, 307 and 3 quarters, down 6. May corn, 195 and a half, down 2 and 3 quarters. July, 203 and a half, down 3. September, 211 and 3 quarters, down 3. December, 221 and a quarter, down 3. May beans, 619 and a half, down 8 and a half.